I was not able to print out my poem, so I wanted to start with a poem. And this is one of my favorites from Rilke. It's called The Swan. And there are many translations, but this one is from Robert Bly. This clumsy living that moves lumbering as if in ropes through what is not done reminds us of the awkward way the swan walks. And to die, which is the letting go of the ground we stand on and cling to every day, is like the swan when he nervously lets himself down into the water, which receives him gaily and which flows joyfully under and after him, wave after wave, while the swan, unmoving and marvelously calm, is pleased to be carried, each moment more fully grown, more majestically, further and further on. What I deeply appreciate about this poem is that it acknowledges the awkwardness involved in being human. That feeling of as if being in ropes, lumbering through what is not done. And the contrast between that and when the swan enters kind of the element in which it belongs, there's a kind of effortless gliding that happens. So I think as we start to explore, approach, deepen concentration, this aspect of concentration, we'll experience all of that. We'll experience the scatteredness, the agitation, the restlessness, the awkward, not able to settle, perhaps. And also, as we cultivate and deepen, we will experience at times a kind of effortless gliding. So there's a point at which concentration or samadhi takes effort, it takes adjusting, it takes maneuvering, and then there is a point where it's no longer effortful, where it's as though we're balanced or held or in a supportive condition. So we're experimenting and experiencing how the mind does that, the mind's capacity to do that. And so we've come to the last fold of the Eightfold Path, and in this last section, effort, mindfulness, and concentration are all supporting each other. They're all continually interweaving. So before I go into specifics around that, I don't usually do this, but I thought I would just read a little bit, something that I wrote, just as kind of an overview. And this doesn't happen very often, but sometimes when I'm preparing for a talk, just like a few paragraphs will come out. So I thought I would just read that. And not making any claims at all, but in the early teachings, there are all of these examples of people becoming awakened, becoming concentrated, and then awakened listening to a talk. So, not saying anything. No pressure. But we can be concentrated while we're listening. So concentration is this state of easeful and joyful kind of immersion in an experience, in what's happening. We're not being diverted. We're content to stay. We're absorbed and immersed in the experience. So that has a profound effect. It kind of penetrates in a different way. Anyway, so I thought I'd just experiment and start with some reading. In part, so you don't have to follow my meanderings of mind around as haphazardly. Okay. So I've been very interested in what samadhi looks like in a lay life off retreat in an ongoing way. Retreat supports it. Even then, it can be difficult. But off retreat, it is a revolutionary practice to undertake. Like I said last month with mindfulness, it is a reclaiming of our attention in a radical way. Gregory Kramer says, unifying the mind is a point of rebellion, but also a healing one. Healing is about wholeness. So one way of describing samadhi is one-pointedness, but it is also unification or wholeness of mind. Not being scattered or distracted, but also not being fixated. Fixation strains the mind. Wholeness is healing, but also powerful. Samadhi is the term the Buddha used for the last grouping of factors on the Eightfold Path. It refers to the ability the mind has to gather together, to collect and unify. It is the opposite of distractedness, scatteredness, and restlessness. It arises when the mind is able to stay connected to an aspect of the present moment's experience for longer and longer periods of time. When we apply just enough of the right kind of effort to sustain mindfulness, we enter samadhi. When the mind is samadhied, collected, gathered, unified, the hindrances are temporarily held at bay. Ajahn Suchito says, samadhi isn't something you do, it is something you enter. Isn't something you do, it is something you enter. Concentration, another, as it is sometimes translated, was much of what the Buddha practiced before he awakened. He was said to have practiced very refined states of concentration, surpassing his teachers, but he found that he always came back out again, still suffering. He realized that it was not an end in and of itself. The Buddha's radical approach was that while concentration wasn't a helpful aim in and of itself, it was extremely useful, even necessary for the deepening of wisdom. It was the middle way. The Buddha's approach was also practical and empowering. We don't have to just sit here and wait for the mind to gather, in the same way that we wouldn't just hang out waiting for a mystical experience to happen. At the same time, you can't strive and strain your way to samadhi. You continually frustrate yourself and muck it up. An example I've always loved from Kitty Sorrow, former monk in the Thai forest tradition, is of someone trying to get the waves in the ocean to settle down by flinging their arms around and trying to flatten them out. This is often what the restless, agitated mind is like when it is trying to do calm concentration. Instead, we can work with attitudes and approaches that are helpful for entering samadhi. We can get skilled at it. When we can do that and are practiced at it, it becomes less of a random occurrence and more like another setting or mode that we can enter when the conditions are right. Even though the Buddha wasn't interested in indulging blissful states for their own sake, he also recognized that there was a kind of pleasure that was not to be feared, but instead could be used skillfully. This was a kind of pleasure that didn't depend on getting something good and stimulating from the outside, but from simplicity and letting go, or easing in. Samadhi is described not as forced focus, but as a pleasant abiding here and now. It is connected with steadiness, calm, and a kind of preliminary equanimity. So it's just a kind of overview to what we're talking about when we talk about samadhi or concentration. Many of us have ideas about concentration and whether or not we can do it. We tend to have very kind of fixed views about whether or not we can do it. How many people identify themselves as having a very scattered mind? Yeah, as part of your identity. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And how many people, as part of that scattered identity, have become very, you either feel intensely kind of graspy about concentration, or you've decided this isn't for me at all. I can never do it. One of the two. How many people have fallen on one of the two camps? Yes. Okay. So I think the Buddha's pointing to something right in between, as usually is the case, the middle way in between those two, that it isn't something that we need to force and strain ourselves to, but it also isn't something that we disregard or that we need to feel is off limits for us entirely. So don't be afraid and don't be fixated on concentration. that's the encouragement. So let go of any ideas you might have of whether or not you can do it, whether or not you are a scattered mess or really good at it. So we all have this capacity of mind. And given the appropriate conditions, can deepen this, can actualize this. We can remain undistracted and unfixated. It is possible. So an important part to keep in mind about concentration is that if it's sama samadhi, or this right concentration, is that it's accompanied by calm and ease. Right? So we can be very one-pointed, we can be very whole in our attention, but not have this accompaniment of ease and calm. So my dog, I debated the two titles for this talk. One was embodied samadhi, and the other was training the puppy. So maybe both of those will enter in at some point. But when my dog is waiting for a treat, as he has been trained to do, he will stay completely still, focused, complete eye contact, completely focused, not a muscle moving, but everything in him is just waiting. It's like saliva dripping off of his mouth, drool dripping, and he's just completely grasping, intent, waiting for that payoff, right? So that might be a certain kind of one-pointedness, but that is not That is not samadhi. Again, samadhi is more something that we enter. So next I want to just talk about some pointers that help us cultivate this quality. So people have been debating for decades, longer, probably hundreds of years, about how much concentration you need for insight or for wisdom to arise, right? I don't think we're ever going to find an answer to this. This is not an exact science, but from the most kind of relatively ordinary steadiness of mind, just the mind's ability to stay steady and undistracted in the midst of chaos and stimulation, to deep states of absorption. Wherever we cultivate on that continuum, it can be beneficial. And the same principles or same pointers apply no matter where we are exploring on that continuum. The states of deep absorption that are pointed to in the suttas, so the jhanas, require a certain kind of refined atmosphere. And it can be extremely valuable and transformative to pursue that. And not many of us, and probably all of us at some point, are not in those conditions. Right? So I've been really very kind of interested in and dedicated to what are the forms of samadhi that can be helpful as a practitioner in everyday life, living in a city, living with the bombardment of distractions as we do. So what is helpful for us in these conditions, not just retreat conditions? So the first thing that's helpful is that we really have to sense the value of a concentrated mind, or a samadhied mind, a gathered mind, a collected mind. Especially, I was thinking about this last night, the last couple of days have just been such intense news days. I mean, most of them are at this point. But just breathtakingly awful, and so I was trying to absorb that and thinking about that and how is concentration helpful in that, and. This quote came to me from, this is from the Sutta Nipata. Let's see what I'm doing. Oh, it's here, that's why. So this is from the Sutta Nipata. It's very short. Going down to a river that is flooded and turbulent, if you are swept away by the current, how can you help others across? Going down to a river that is flooded and turbulent, if you are swept away by the current, how can you help others across? So often I'll start my practice, whatever form it takes, with a strong intention that whatever I'm doing will be of benefit for all beings. And that intention gives a kind of meaning and purposefulness to the kind of awkwardness that we have to wade through as we're sitting. It gives a kind of purposefulness to that. I know the difference in daily life between how I am in relationship with work, with just about everything, between when I'm gathered and when I'm not. I can feel that difference. And so without setting up another kind of moral good-bad paradigm for myself, we can still value the process that we undergo as being holding the intention that it be useful for all beings. And we know that a gathered, collected, steadied mind is more useful. Yeah. So as best we're able, those who were with Philip Moffat this last weekend online, one of his phrases, which we've been coming back to for years, is as best I'm able. So as best I'm able, can I steer my mind in a helpful direction towards steadiness, towards gatheredness? So the first thing that's helpful is just to see the value in doing that. So I just heard the other day, remember, Dan Harris, who has the 10% Happier podcast, he was talking with Joseph Goldstein, wonderful interviews, but he just got a tattoo somewhere on his wrist, and many people I know have tattoos right on wrists and forearms and hands, or the reminder is very direct. But this was FTBOAB, for the benefit of all beings. And I thought that was a wonderful reminder, especially because he prides himself in his identity as a skeptic, right, and a cynic. So clearly there's been some kind of transformation. So anyway, with concentration, we see the value in it. We remember why we're doing it. We're not just a dog waiting for a pleasurable experience. When we move towards concentration, we're actually making the mind much more useful, much more serviceable, much more malleable, able to be used in a helpful direction. So one of the first steps in that is guarding the senses. So remembering that guarding the senses is helpful. And this is a phrase that comes up in the early teachings again and again. And I was once asked by a teacher to notice my state when I woke up first thing in the morning. Just notice my state and to write down everything I noticed about the first moment of waking up in the morning. And this is a humbling experience if you've never done this. Humbling and sobering. So my mind tends towards aversion. Maybe yours is different. But when I first noticed this years ago, there was an immediate kind of churning. Okay, what's next? What hadn't been finished? Responding in my mind to work and conversations almost on the moment of awakening. And then, you know, body a little uncomfortable, a little grumpy, things are aching, a little dehydrated. It was a lot of physical, mental, emotional residue. I'll call it residue. And the immediate impulse, of course, is to do something to make that better. Right? To look at something, to watch something, to get going on the tasks, to alleviate the discomfort, to ingest something, to take something in right away. And of course, that often makes it worse. And we don't get the experience of not responding for a little while. Guarding the senses means not taking in any other input for a little while so that we can give the heart mind a chance to settle and soothe. So we're not having to respond. We're just letting the kind of echoes of what's been ingested kind of ring out or settle and soothe. So guarding the senses means protecting the mind in a certain way. Not forever, doesn't mean we're retreating forever, but we give a little bit of time every day to not taking in anything new through through any of the senses. Yeah. And it doesn't mean we go numb, but it means that we are able to just be there with the senses awake, alive, available, but not being fed. Not being fed. So we can do this as a morning practice. We can do this as an evening practice. But it's vital to have some regular time where you're not being stimulated. And one of the primary impediments to this is boredom. Yeah, is boredom and discomfort. So some of you have heard me talk about this several times over the last couple weeks, but there is a device now called the Brick. Maybe you've heard of it. Have you heard of this? I just mentioned this at Under 40 the other night, but this is a Brick the Brick is a device where you can pay $50 to be blocked out of your own phone, to not have access to your own apps. So this is a way to pay someone to guard your senses for you. Yeah. So we can get very creative about this, but we have to know that you will meet the hindrances. You have to know that and expect that and not be thrown by that and not conclude that this doesn't work or I can't concentrate. So guarding the senses, give yourself some time during the day where you're not taking in input. The mind can settle. This is a setting that we have. So along with that, we can learn to experiment with different objects and enjoy them. So this is a crucial part. We can experiment with which object is most suitable for us at any given time. Yeah. It doesn't mean that it's immediately going to catapult us into pristine stillness or bliss. But you're looking for an object that is good enough, that you can connect with, that you can that has a sense of simplicity and neutrality around it, and even a little bit of pleasantness. So this aspect is really important, and I like to emphasize this a lot when I'm talking about concentration, because we can be afraid of this kind of pleasure in our practice. And over again in the early teachings, we're invited to not only notice it, but be fully aware of this kind of pleasure and absorb into it. So really take it in and absorb into it. And let this make an impression on the body, heart, mind. So I'm not talking about the kind of pleasure that's like a hit of coffee or ice cream or some TikTok or something else. But this is more like just appreciating the texture of your socks. Yeah. Or the feeling of your feet touching the carpet as you're walking. It's appreciating the simplicity of not having anything else to do right now, and the kind of spaciousness that that involves. It's sensing the kind of vitality of your senses, the aliveness that's there when nothing is being fed, and yet you're still vibrantly, dynamically alive. So the Buddha was very clear that there's a particular kind of pleasure that helped break our kind of addiction to seeking pleasure out there. So it was helpful in becoming more independent in the practice. And this is also extremely helpful for those of us with backgrounds of trauma, right? So it's the same often instruction. So I know in the household that I grew up in, there was an extreme amount of volatility, right? It was extreme amount of volatility. There was a lot of love and care and kindness, but it was volatile. It could change at any moment. So there's a kind of hypervigilance that it's just kind of part of my makeup and nervous system. And in this mode of hypervigilance, it's very difficult to even imagine that the mind could settle, right? Because for very good reasons, we're alert and scanning for danger. And often overly attuned to signals of danger and potential threat and hostility and the tide turning. But what we can gradually steer towards are signals and impressions of safety, of friendship, of kindness that's around us. It does not have to be perfect, but also the places in which we are safe and okay already. Safe enough already, okay enough already. It might be something as simple as in this moment, I'm warm enough, my body is healthy enough to be here. There is nobody that is kind of coming at me with hostility in this moment. Yeah. There are others surrounding with kindness and a sincerity of intent. It's not just noting that with one's intellect, not just a cursory noting. Oh yeah, I'm healthy enough. Yeah, I'm warm, I'm full, I had enough to eat. It's using that capacity, that absorptive capacity of the mind to sustain attention there, to hold attention there, so that that's where the deep learning takes place. These two aspects of concentration, as they're talked about, whether it's a more sustained mindfulness or deep absorption, are vitaka vichara. So sometimes they're talked about as aiming and sustaining, which can sound very effortful. But another way to think about it is it's the ability that we have to place our attention on something that's helpful, whatever our suitable object is, be the warmth in the heart, could be somebody's kind smile, could be feeling well-fed, could be the warmth of our hands. That's the placing or the aiming. And then the second part is much more receptive. And this is where we can take in and really learn in a nervous system level the qualities of safety and skillful pleasure. So this is the sensing or the sustaining. I prefer sensing. So Ajahn Suchito talks about placing and sensing. This is we sense into the qualities around the object that we've chosen. So we let our mind stay there, and with curiosity and sensitivity, we sense into what that's like. That's when it becomes an embodied learning rather than just a mental note. So to use the skillful pleasure that we can be aware of as we're sitting as a way of training the mind, forming deep impressions that change the circuitry of our systems so that we can respond to threats as they arise, as we need to be active and take action. But when the threats are no longer present, we have other ways of steering and navigating towards steadiness, towards stability, towards gathering back in of attention. And this is not easy, so I'm talking about it kind of quickly, but this is a process. But wanted to just mention the importance of really letting ourselves enjoy the object, seeing the value in concentration, guarding the senses, playing with this ability for placing and sensing, and allowing deeper experiences of pleasure when we sit. So in the teachings, as it talks about deepening into concentration, the objects become kind of finer and finer. Yeah. So we can experiment with that. At first, we might start just with the pleasure of the mind not being fixated. It feels really good not to be fixated. So we can start just with that, and then kind of perhaps move into be subtler and subtler levels of pleasure. So for instance, with the dog, I don't at all mean to be like condescending at all to dogs or to humans, but it often reminds me, this mind training is often referred to as like training a puppy. And why I think that's a helpful parallel is that the overall attitude that we have towards the puppy is one of affection and tenderness. Yeah. We don't begrudge the puppy's lack of development, usually, sometimes not. But the first move is usually one of just appreciation and adoration. Yeah. So as we're approaching concentration, let our first move be that one of friendliness and connection and affection. I have a reminder on my fridge. This comes from Dan Siegel. It refers to parenting. It says, connect, then redirect. connect, then redirect. So this is true for our own minds too. We connect first with our own goodness, our own capacity, those experiences that are non-agitating, then we can steer a little bit. So eventually the puppy, I hear, it's not true for me yet, but the puppy doesn't need the cheese anymore. You know, they're so thrilled just with your attention that they don't need the cheese. We're not there yet. But, and then they don't even need your approval anymore because they're trained, right? They're content, yeah, to stay. And the aim of the training is not, maybe on some level it's to have a well-behaved dog or a well-behaved mind, but the aim of the training also is so the dog can be a free dog without harming himself or anyone else, right? He can be off leash without swallowing a crab leg or running over somebody who has a walker or any of that. The dog knows what's skillful and what isn't skillful. The dog can be its full dogness. Yeah. So the point of concentration is wisdom and freedom. The point of concentration is wisdom and freedom, and we get there through skillful pleasure, through directing and sensing, through the ability of the mind to absorb, but to use that not as an end in of itself, but so that we can experience our full capacities of mind. When the mind is steady and still, we can see more clearly. It's like the lake that is calm is the lake that we can see through to, we can see down into, but also see our own reflection. So the steady mind allows clear seeing, allows wisdom, and ultimately allows freedom. So concentration, the last fold of the path, doesn't end. It could, it could, but it feeds back into right view, which is the first fold, right, of the path. So it forms a spiral. So the ability to gather and unify our attention, our mind, changes our view and allows the path to keep turn, allows the wheel to keep turning, allows the path to continue to deepen and open. So it's beautiful that way. The practice is beautiful that way. So the invitation around Samadhi is really around creativity and enjoyment, allowing ourselves skillful pleasure, and knowing the value of it, not assuming it's off the table for us, but also knowing that it is not an end in and of itself. Right, so I hope some of this was helpful tonight. And I'd love to just hear from you a little bit. So I have some prompts if you'd like, but before I offer those, maybe just see if anything comes up for you, anybody. And questions or your own reflections.
There we go. Sorry. My question is, you know, taking that break or, you know, giving your time regarding your senses and all of that, it's kind of, for me, I was been experimenting with like, okay, mind, you can take a break. You don't have to be on every minute. I don't need you right now, kind of thing. And that was really, I don't know if that's what you're talking about, but that's what happened today. The other question about objects. Can you expand on that a little bit? You know, I'm thinking like fidgets, you know, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. So that's all.
Yeah. First, the turning towards maybe your version of the hypervigilance or the being on all the time, your phrase, and turning towards that with compassion. It's like appreciating it, respecting it, but thank you. I don't need that right now. Yeah, that seems like a very skillful way to relate to some of our, you know, our patterns and tendencies that keep us like looking out and going out all the time. You know, that's not some like evil aberration that we're doing that. That's a skillful protective mechanism. Yeah. But it's also on overdrive for most of us, for a lot of us. So that seems like a really skillful way. Like, oh, thank you for trying to protect me. And right now we're okay. We're okay. Yeah. So that's great. And then the objects. So it's funny that you mentioned fidgets, because we are fidgets coming out of our every drawer at home is filled with fidgets. But objects is the word that's used in the early teachings for what we bring our attention to, right? So in a way, each of the foundations or establishments of mindfulness is a kind of object. So it's what we steer towards. And objects can sound kind of clunky. But object, your chosen object could be sensations in the body, could be breathing, could be, again, the warmth of hands, often mentioned sound or hearing, could be one of the sense doors. So an object can also be a capacity, you know, so we can be aware of hearing. Yeah, it's not so much that we're aware of a certain sound, but we're more bringing all of our awareness to the openness of hearing, and then objects are coming and going. So we're not getting fixated on one particular object or one particular point in the body, but we're kind of opening to a capacity or a field of experience, or we're choosing to kind of orient or gather around one particular area. Yeah. Yeah, container. Yep. So that depends on our ability to place our attention. I like the word invite. You know, that feels a little too forceful otherwise, but everyone can do what works for them. But it's like inviting our awareness to connect with one aspect of the present moment's experience. So it's like connect, return, stay. And we do that not in like a punitive, like we're telling a dog to stay, but eventually something shifts where we can recognize that, it feels good to stay. It feels good to connect. So that's the kind of placing and sensing. So the first part is connecting with the object or the area, kind of steering ourselves into the territory, and then sensing into what's it like. Okay, so I'm aware of the warmth of my hands. Yeah. So without words, we have to verbalize it to ourselves. It's pleasant. It was warm, tingly, not agitated. Yeah. Simple, natural connection. Does that speak to it a bit? Thanks, Leslie. Yeah, Ryan.
I found myself this morning, or I mean this weekend, puttering around all weekend, working on projects around the house for a run. At one point, I sort of observed that I had been listening to podcasts the whole weekend, like while doing everything.
Yeah.
I was running and listening, and I was... And then I was working on stuff, and then I was out in the yard, and then I was fixing some things, and there was a point at which I did have this little insight of like, wow, I'm sort of filling my brain constantly, even as I'm doing all these other things. And so then it caught my attention during your talk about how sometimes we just need to not have any inputs into our brain. And so I just wondered if you could expand on that a little bit more about something caught my attention that like, should I be filling my brain this much all the time? But so maybe just a little bit more about why it's important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what's helpful there is to, you know, the Buddha is very practical. So in terms of shoulds and should nots, he's very practical. So you might just see, okay, what are you getting out of that? You know, what are you getting out of feeding your mind constantly like that? And then what's the drawback of it, right? So in a way we're, and I do it too. I listen to a lot of podcasts and notice that there's a certain kind of inspiration and it can help direct my mind in a certain way. But I'm also becoming, you know, you can watch that, you can develop a kind of reliance or dependency on that. So I bet I often take polls, how many people, you know, listen to apps or talks to help them meditate. Probably most people. So at some point, but at some point to take that as part of the steering and then experience your mind like unsupported or unpropped up, like not having input. Because even if there's something coming in, we're still a little bit split, listening and observing. And it's not that we can't do both, but there's a little bit of a split. So not at all that it's bad. Like, do what's helpful as long as it's helpful. But you might notice, does that become kind of compulsive? So we're just kind of feeding the next podcast or the next inspiring book or talk instead of getting to know the mind that's unguided, like without input. And in order to do that, we'll probably experience a drop. This is what people experience when they go on retreat, and all of a sudden you're not stimulated anymore. There's nothing coming in. You know, there's not, you know, you're watching squirrels or, you know, staring into the middle of a banana, or, you know, there's like nothing stimulating. But it's a little bit of a detox. Like you get the mind drops or sinks. And so we have to be able to withstand that. It's like coming out of a minor form of addiction. Can we stand? So the woman who did the study on herself with the brick and did the review of it, whether it was useful, blocked out of her apps. She said, I didn't realize that the problem wasn't my device, but the problem was I couldn't stand being bored. You know. So there's a certain amount of unpleasantness and working with the hindrances that we often, that it's so helpful to have that skill set to be able to identify them. Oh, my mind is restless. My mind is sinking. You know, my mind is agitated, and not make an identity out of that, but just to recognize that as a state moving through. So, so helpful. So we can't do that as well if we don't have some seclusion time. Yeah. So one other aspect that maybe people can consider this for next time is, and this has to do with objects. But there is a way in which we can move through daily life with a kind of steadiness that is more an experience of flow rather than being completely absorbed in one object or completely connected and united with just one thing. It's like we're moving in between changing experiences and conditions, but we're staying steady within them. So this is an experience of flow in daily life. So flow has been studied a lot, but in terms of samadhi, this is an experience that many of us might have naturally arising in certain activities. Yeah? Playing sports that we love, or doing art that we enjoy, or having conversations with friends that are skillful and wholesome and not overly exciting. But this ability to gather and collect the mind can happen when our bodies are still, but can also happen as we're moving through the tasks and demands of everyday life. That is a form of samadhi. So we can experiment with that, experience that. And our, speaking of objects, it's not that we try to kind of keep ourselves fixed, like, okay, I've got to stay aware of the breath and what I'm saying at the same time, like not trying to like juggle. But we're just lightly aware of how awareness moves between objects as we flow through activities. So maybe it moves from being with our body in motion as we're walking through a room. And then it's on an awareness of our emotional state for a while. Then it's aware of our care for the other person or speech that's coming out of our mouths. So there's a way that samadhi can also be an embodied flow. So one of the questions that I was going to ask you, what are your examples or experiences of being either immersed in something contentedly so that time and self-consciousness have fallen away, like you're at ease? Like, what are your experiences of being immersed in something? And are there experiences of that kind of easeful flow, moving in between activities in between objects, events. So getting to know some of the conditions in which this might naturally arise and what helps support those states. Okay. This also will, stop. So to be curious, naturally arising states, one arena, many arenas, also this experience of pleasure. So to notice what is my relationship to pleasure and ease in meditation? Is it a part of it? Do I allow it? Am I afraid of it? Do I crave more of it? What is my experience, like, relationship with that? Okay, so I think we'll close there for tonight. Appreciate your attention tonight. Maybe we'll just dedicate the merit for a moment since we started. Brought kindness into the guided sit, so maybe we just close, just easing back in for a moment to the experience of body. Any sense of kindness, appreciation, friendliness? And just in the same way that we kind of wordlessly expanded and extended that during the sit, we can form the intention that the benefits of our practice be shared. So whatever softening or inspiration or connectedness, insight, whatever benefit may have arisen from our practice tonight, may it be shared. May it be offered. May it be of use, of great benefit to all beings everywhere without exception. May each of us and all beings be well in body and mind. May we be free of confusion and fear. May we take care of ourselves and each other with ease. And may we continue to move in the direction of wisdom, compassion, and freedom in our own unique ways. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for your practice.